Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Osama bin Laden is gone, the 9/11 mastermind and terrorist icon killed by American commandos. A big target taken down. But there are still 100,000 American troops on the ground in Afghanistan fighting. For how long and for what now exactly? We've heard news of progress, but also of prison breaks, uniformed Afghans killing Americans, Kabul being urged to dump the U.S. for China. This hour on Point, Afghanistan after bin Laden. You can join the conversation. It's been almost 10 years. When and how, at what point, should the war in Afghanistan end? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's one Chicago resident, Linda Lulis, talking to NPR yesterday about the death of bin Laden and American troops overseas.
You know, my first reaction was kind of a relief that perhaps now we can wrap things up over there and get more troops home.
Perhaps. But here was a Taliban spokesman speaking Pashto, pledging that Osama bin Laden's death would be avenged. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the United States will continue the fight that the Taliban cannot wait out, the USA.
Our message to the Taliban remains the same, but today it may have even greater resonance. You cannot wait us out. You cannot defeat us, but you can make the choice to abandon al-Qaeda and participate in a peaceful political process.
We're going to look this hour at the war in Afghanistan and when and how it ends on this side of Osama bin Laden's death. Joining me first today from Kabul is Alyssa Rubin, Kabul bureau chief for The New York Times. Alyssa, thank you very much for being with us today. What's the reaction been in Kabul to the news out of Pakistan of bin Laden's demise?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Well, I think the reaction here has been rather muted, and it's a little bit hard to say exactly why that is. There are a number of different factors. One of them is that the Taliban is both a local movement that is, to some extent, a genuine insurgency, an anti-government rebellion, and it is also strongly influenced and supplied by the Pakistani intelligence services and also by other groups that are active in Pakistan across the border, and the larger al-Qaeda network, which is asunder as well. So having bin Laden be killed and leave the scene doesn't necessarily affect people here and the insurgency here in a direct way. So I think people are very wary that this will bring a change in their lives.
And what about Afghan officialdom? Hamid Karzai and others, have they spoken about the demise of Osama bin Laden?
Yes, they have. And their main theme is one that we've heard for some time, but even more, and yesterday it was even more pronounced. Their view is that this is what they have been saying all along, that the origins of the terrorism that has traumatized their country for many, many years is in Pakistan, and that the U.S. is in essence fighting its war in the wrong place. I was speaking yesterday to the National Security Advisor, Rangin Spanta, and he said the geography of war needs to change, and he meant really the geographical place of the war, that it needs to be fought in Pakistan's tribal areas. Now, that is to some extent because it has been very uncomfortable for the Afghan government to deal with some of the civilian casualties that have happened, some of the sense of resentment of having foreign troops on their soil. There is an element of convenience to it. But it is also true that there would not be the kind of support for the Taliban that there is were there not the safe havens and sanctuaries for them in Pakistan.
Alyssa, there are a few very broad elements of a timetable for U.S. withdrawal on the table already. Walk us through those. July, a beginning of a drawdown, and 2014, what's supposed to happen then?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a progression. It is all about what is being called transition, the transition to Afghan control of security, Afghan control of all the money that comes into the country. At the moment, a lot of it is controlled by, some extent, the U.S., to some extent, the World Bank. There are a whole variety of methods of getting funding into the country. But in July, the understanding is that President Obama will begin to withdraw troops. How many troops will be withdrawn, and what the how many in July, how many in September, how many, that has not been determined. And one of the big debates right now in Washington is what the rate of withdrawal will be and whether the death of Osama bin Laden might increase the number and the speed with which the combat troops withdraw. By 2014, there is a broad agreement endorsed by NATO at the Lisbon conference and in London last February, a year ago, all of the troops would, combat troops would be gone, and Afghanistan would be responsible, in essence, for its own security. Whether that's realistic or not, there's much debate, but that is the schedule.
Debate in Kabul and debate in Washington. We've seen all the news of the fighting season beginning again now. During the sort of winter lull, if we can call it that, there were claims of real progress by General Petraeus and others. Of course, he's now going to the CIA. There were several specific incidents in the last few days, week or so, Alyssa, that I wish you could speak to with us. First of all, there's this claim of progress, and then we see this giant jailbreak from Kandahar, 400 or 500 Taliban prisoners escaping from a tunnel dug right underneath the political section of the Kandahar prison. That seems to speak not to the competence of Afghan troops or progress exactly, but the opposite. What's the significance of that? The U.S. troops spent a lot of time putting those guys in jail.
Right. Well, yes, that is all true. I think it speaks to an insurgency that is still very much alive, that has many connections with both the political establishment as well as the tribal establishment. It speaks to a culture, what has become something of a culture of corruption. I don't think Afghans are necessarily innately corrupt. That would be quite unfair to say. But people are poor, and people also have the sense that the U.S. is going to leave soon, so they want to make as much money as possible while they're here. And so there's a lot of money floating around, and probably money was paid to quite a number of people. There have been somewhere between 10 and 17 of the employees of the, I suppose there have been 10 who are now under arrest, another 17 have been dismissed of employees in the prison, police who were involved in guarding the prison. But it was probably a much broader and larger plan than that, since they were digging for 5 or 6 months and into a neighborhood which was patrolled by the police. There are many, many questions that are unanswered. But it speaks to, as I said, an insurgency that is not it's not disconnected from the people. To some extent, these are Kandahari and Helmand province sons who are in prison, and people know them. There's not a bright line necessarily.
And then the killing in the north of 8 American uniformed military, 1 American contractor, by an Afghan military officer. Do we understand that any better yet? He came in and more or less executed them in a meeting room there. But why? And what about this? What does it say about Afghan uniformed attitudes toward the American presence, if anything?
Well, I think that's a very important point and a very sensitive area. That actually happened here in Kabul at the Kabul International Airport. The Afghan military section of it. And I think the sense is on that particular case that he was mentally ill and not a plant by the Taliban. But there have been cases of infiltration by the Taliban into the armed, into the security forces, and there has been infiltration simply by suicide bombers who put on the clothes of members of the security force. And so, and there have been about 16 cases, I believe, which have involved people wearing security force clothes. Some of them actual infiltrators, in other words, people who joined the military with the idea that down the line they would commit either a suicide bombing or a shooting that would result in their own death, and other cases where people were actually wearing uniforms. But this is obviously a problem, and it's something the U.S. and NATO is, trainers are extremely worried about, because they thought they had vetted everyone, but obviously they didn't. Now, I don't know, on the mental health cases, those are harder to anticipate, I think.
Alyssa, we've just got half a minute here. In a word, how long do you think Afghans on the street think American soldiers will be in their country? Do U.S. military have any idea?
I think Afghans are very nervous about the possibility of departure, so they would like to believe we would be here forever or for a very long time, even though they resent having us here and seeing us. So there's that constant tension, but they are very nervous about being left without some kind of large force which has a lot of resources.
Alyssa Rubin, you're terrific. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the war in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's death and when and how it ends. Yesterday, Afghan President Hamid Karzai spoke to an assembly of Afghan government officials about the death of Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden, Darak Amaliyat.
Bin Laden received his due punishment, says Afghan President Hamid Karzai. His hands were dipped in the blood of thousands and thousands of children, youths, and elders of Afghanistan.
But that doesn't mean it's over. Here's General David Petraeus, now headed to the CIA, if he gets confirmed there, no doubt he will, speaking to Congress in March about U.S. military, he said, progress in Afghanistan.
The momentum achieved by the Taliban in Afghanistan since 2005 has been arrested in much of the country and reversed in a number of important areas. However, while the security progress achieved over the past year is significant, it is also fragile and reversible. Moreover, it is clear that much difficult work lies ahead with our Afghan partners to solidify and expand our gains in the face of the expected Taliban spring offensive.
David Petraeus in March in testimony in Washington. Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Biddle. He's Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was at the U.S. Army War College from 2001 to 2006, has advised Generals Petraeus and McChrystal on counterinsurgency policy. Stephen Biddle, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Seaside, California, is Thomas Johnson, director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. He's been studying Afghanistan and South Asia for 2 decades. Thomas Johnson, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Stephen Biddle, remind us, if you would, of what, I mean, we know 9/11, you know, the simple formula is 9/11 took us into Afghanistan, but remind us of the strategic thinking that took us to Afghanistan. What was the goal? What's the goal now?
Well, the original goal was to get Osama bin Laden and destroy a state government that had provided safe haven to him. Over time, a variety of things have changed in South Asia that have changed the stakes for the United States in the conflict. In particular, there is a roiling insurgency in Pakistan, which has led to a substantial decay in the stability of that state, and Al-Qaeda Global has moved from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Pakistan, of course, is a nuclear weapon power. In the event that an unstable Pakistan tips over into state collapse, that nuclear arsenal could breach containment. That's, I think, one of the few plausible ways by which...
When you say breach containment, you mean fall into the hands potentially of terrorists.
Absolutely. And that's one of the few ways I can think of by which you could imagine that happening. That's an important national security stake for the United States. The stability of Afghanistan on Pakistan's western border influences that in important ways.
So are we now in Afghanistan as a kind of stability prop against Pakistan? And if so, is that working?
That's one of several important U.S. stakes in Afghanistan. In my view, it's the most important of them. Is it working? At the moment, Afghanistan is not a major contributor to the problems inside Pakistan. It would be much nicer if we could deal with Pakistani stability directly by somehow or another affecting the course of the war within Pakistan for the better. The trouble is we have very little influence over that conflict. One of the few things we can control in South Asia, to at least some degree, is what happens on the other side of the Durand Line. That's, I think, one of the major reasons why we're there and doing what we're doing.
You've been talking positively about some elements of progress in Afghanistan. At the same time, you write in the Boston Globe today that the effort, you say, for me, it's been worth it, but only barely. Why such a close balance here?
Well, I think we have important stakes in Afghanistan, but they're not unlimited. Actually, like a fair number of places around the world, it matters to us what happens there, but it doesn't matter to us infinitely. What we would like to do in an ideal world is to say we have important but not unlimited stakes, therefore we ought to make important but limited commitments to secure them. The trouble is limited commitments very rarely succeed when, although the stakes to us are limited, the stakes to the locals are existential. We've seen that in all sorts of places, Libya and elsewhere. In Afghanistan, we're stuck with this problem where if we're going to affect the situation for the better, it's going to require a larger investment than we would otherwise like to make. So that puts us on the horns of a dilemma as to whether a large scale of expenditure and sacrifice is worth the pursuit of interests that are real and important but limited. And that's why I think it's a close call on the merits. It boils down to how individuals are going to cast a value judgment between reducing a risk and making a sacrifice.
Thomas Johnson, it's American resources, American lives, it's reputation from many different angles here. It doesn't necessarily mean just stay in. There's also the issue of civilian deaths in Afghanistan, which there's always been that drumbeat of. Now Osama bin Laden is dead. Think about with us, Thomas Johnson, about the timetable here. Is there an obvious timetable, short, long, midterm? What should it be?
Well, I think we're still sorting out some of those questions in Washington, but I think that it's clear in the minds of Afghans that we're going to be getting out or we'll have a limited engagement after 2014. And I think that many Afghans are viewing their everyday life relative to that. I think as Ms. Rubin suggested earlier, that Afghans are sort of living for the day. There's massive corruption from the cobbler to the president's office, and people are trying to take as much NATO-U.S. money as they can right now relative to contracts and other things. So I think the real problem in Afghanistan is that the Afghans have lost patience with the United States. I think most Afghans, almost all Afghans, welcomed us into the country in October of 2001 with open arms, but they had high expectations that security and justice and infrastructure would be improved. And I think many Afghans look at us as not fulfilling our promises. And that's one thing that you don't want to do to an Afghan. I mean, you have to be very careful in the promises you make. So I think basically the population has lost patience with us. I think that in many respects, and much of this comes from my last 3 years that I've spent in Kandahar in the south of Afghanistan, revolves around the fact that we've become, in the eyes of the Afghans, part of the problem rather than part of the solution. I think that's very damning.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, there was also a kind of promise to the American people here that Afghanistan would not again become a base for the kind of terrorism we saw hit this country on September 11th, 2001. Is that still a threat, a danger? Many things have changed here. Now bin Laden himself is gone. If U.S. troops pull out, Afghan troops are more or maybe less successful in securing that country. Is there still a risk of this becoming a full-on terrorist base again, or is that history?
Well, I think that's a key question, and I think some of the things that we have to think about here is that I believe that the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban of 2001, was very different than what we presently face, the Afghan Taliban of 2011. Now, I think it's important to recognize that the Pakistani Taliban have a much closer or had a much closer relationship with al-Qaeda. I think that the Afghan Taliban, for the last 4 or 5 years, have moved away from al-Qaeda. I think that we had explicit statements from Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, Afghan Taliban, with the Quetta Shura, a number of years ago, suggesting that, you know, he was pulling away from al-Qaeda. So I think that the actual composition and the ideology of the Afghan Taliban is very different than what it was in 2001. Now, while there's always a chance if international forces left and the Taliban, God forbid, came back to power, maybe some terrorist camps would reopen. But I think that we have to take a very serious look at that. I don't believe that the Taliban are that close to al-Qaeda any longer. So, you know, I think that Omar literally gave up his regime in 2001 rather than turn over bin Laden. And I don't think that would ever happen again.
Stephen Biddle, I want to put the same question to you, but a couple of our listeners first, if I may. Lexington, Virginia. John, thanks for calling. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
America's best defense, best policy in Afghanistan is to preserve her goodness. Once we didn't torture. Once we said all people are persons, whether they're citizens or not.
You're talking about a moral toll of war.
Bin Laden knew he could. No, there is no moral equivalent of war. War is evil. War, there is no good war. That's my opinion.
So does that mean withdraw, John?
Yes, it means withdraw.
And what about the danger of Afghanistan once again being a terrorist base?
America's best defense against Islam, of course, it's going to take fighting to destroy Mohammed's religion. It'll take a long time.
You know, John, I'm gonna hold you there. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I mean, it has many followers and many who have expressed happiness to see Osama bin Laden be gone, many who don't support him at all. But there is this issue of moral standing. It's an interesting one. I appreciate your call. Peter in Boston, you're on the air, Peter.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The point I wanted to make about this is I don't think we should pull out, but I think we should shift resources. And just the way you were alluding to earlier, you know, instead of putting money towards our military there, we should put money towards the infrastructure and providing schools and roads and creating a system where they appreciate us so that way it doesn't go back to the same problems that we had from the 70s, from Charlie Wilson's war, like back from at that time. So I completely agree that, you know, we should stay there until our job is done. Our mission was to get Osama bin Laden, but we should make sure that we don't just remove ourselves completely from the situation, otherwise we'll go back to the 70s.
Though if you just do counterinsurgency or humanitarian work, you may end up doing it for a Taliban government. I don't know, but I appreciate your call, Peter. For a moment, let me get Bing West into this conversation. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for during the Reagan administration. He's been out recently with a new book, The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. Bing West, does the death of Osama bin Laden change the equation?
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom. Yes, I think it has, not because of bin Laden himself, but because we finally struck on the ground in Pakistan instead of allowing it to be a sanctuary. And since Mullah Omar is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Americans and we're at war, that we should just continue right now and strike toward Mullah Omar and the other Taliban that are sitting fat and pretty in Pakistan.
Does that turn Pakistan into a war zone, Bing West?
Well, Pakistan is a war zone. The notion of allowing Pakistan to be a sanctuary and to be two-faced and to have Osama bin Laden there next to their military academy should be considered by every American to be an absolute outrage. And there's no reason to allow Mullah Omar, who's responsible for the deaths of thousands of Americans, to be sitting there safe after we've done this to Osama bin Laden. So crank up the pressure.
You're talking about expanding the theater of war then. I mean, the way out of Afghanistan is through Pakistan? Is that what you really mean?
Well, Tom, the definition of expanding, it seems to me the opposite would be to say leave it as a sanctuary. And the answer is no. We're striking Pakistan now. What I'm saying is now that we've shown we have the capacity for putting special operators in the field, on the ground, to get the high command of Al-Qaeda, do the same with the Taliban. Do the same thing and knock the Taliban for a loop and not allow them just to sit in the city of Jeddah protected by the Pakistani services.
Bing West, stand by there in France, if you would. Stephen Biddle, what about it? Can we leave, you know, the mess in Pakistan and get out of Afghanistan, or do you have to deal with Pakistan to leave Afghanistan?
I think Pakistan is the bigger stake. I think it would cut off our nose to spite our face if, in order to pursue what is at the end of the day a means to an end in Afghanistan, we undermine our ability to secure the end by conducting a war in Pakistan that contributes to the collapse of the state in Pakistan and a tremendous increase in the risk of consequent terrorist activity against the United States. It would be emotionally satisfying to respond to the kind of double game that the Pakistanis have been playing for years by saying, enough with you people, we're going to wage war against you, or we're simply going to ignore your preferences and wage war against whom we choose to within your border. But I think the whole problem of South Asia is it's a bunch of tremendously frustrating trade-offs. But you don't escape the trade-offs by just saying you're going to ignore them and go after one end of the spectrum and ignore all the others.
What about the other direction, Thomas Johnson? Are we kind of babysitting Afghanistan as a backup base to deal with Pakistan if it melts down? If we leave Afghanistan, does that have a – which way does that push Pakistan?
Well, I agree with what Stephen had to say. I think there's definitely a nexus between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but I think that Pakistan impacts on Afghanistan much more than Afghanistan impacts on Pakistan. I think that expanding the war into Pakistan would have all types of consequences for the state of Pakistan as well as regional security. I think that Afghanistan, per President Obama's December 2009 speech at West Point, when he suggested that the goal was to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda, well, I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure by the U.S. population to bring troops home from Afghanistan now because many will think that the enemy is mainly gone. But I think there's other things to be had or to be done in Afghanistan if we're going to see a secure state. I personally would like to see more concentrated nation building in the country, but we just don't have the resources to do that. I mean, considering that we spent $30 billion for the surge of 30,000 troops suggests that our long-term commitment on the security side of Afghanistan has to be limited. So, you know, the United States right now is basically pursuing policies in Afghanistan relative to Afghanization of the war. That means basically bringing the transition of the security demands to Afghan national security forces. And I think implicitly the United States would like to see reconciliation and negotiation with the Afghan Taliban. But I think there's problems with both the transition to Afghan national security forces as well as the notion of reconciliation and negotiation with the Taliban.
Bing West, if I may, I just got Bing for another minute here. Bing West, what about reconciliation, nation building, counterinsurgency? Is that the way out of Afghanistan?
Well, look, academic theories can always take you in a circle, but we're fighting a war, and our guys are dying. And to allow Mullah Omar, who's responsible now for about as many American deaths as Osama bin Laden is, to have his sanctuary after we attacked Osama strikes me as being a little bit crazy. If Osama was a legitimate target, so is Mullah Omar. The way you make peace with your enemy is by showing that you're stronger and he isn't going to be able to succeed with his objectives. And giving him a sanctuary the way we have done has prolonged the war and caused more American casualties. We cannot do too much more counterinsurgency in Afghanistan because we, over the last 10 years, have created a culture of entitlement among all Afghans who believe we will give them money and we will do the fighting for them. And until we start to pull our troops out and say, look, we're going to leave you good advisors, but you're going to do your own fighting. And we're going to tell you, Mullah Omar, that wherever you are in Pakistan, we feel that you're a legitimate target. then we'll be able to withdraw, not by doing more nation building and not by doing more counterinsurgency.
Bing West, author of The Wrong War, joining us there from France. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. West. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the war in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's death and when and how it ends. Stephen Biddle joins us, was at the U.S. Army War College, now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, has advised Generals Petraeus and McChrystal on counterinsurgency. Also with us from Seaside, California, is Thomas Johnson, director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Just spent 3 years in the Kandahar region. Kind of a triumphant feeling about the killing of Osama bin Laden. And after all those years and all that work and that hunt and the successful execution, that is understandable. But there have been real setbacks just by the drumbeat in Afghanistan as well, alongside whatever progress we've seen there. That big prison break last week in Kandahar, the heart of the insurgency. Here's Haji Ahmed Khan, a local tribal leader, telling Al Jazeera that he was deeply concerned since many of those prisoners were dangerous Taliban fighters, leaders.
Each of these commanders leads at least 400 fighters, and some of them have a political role in the Taliban. Now these commanders will be leading attacks, so this will have a really bad impact on security and the political situation in the area.
Thomas Johnson joining us in California, Stephen Biddle in Washington, D.C. Let's get our listeners in. Toronto, Canada, Naeem. Naeem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that the war continues in Afghanistan should go on, but the way your author said a minute ago, that we are just giving the money to the people there to become another tribe who is fighting with another tribe. So it's kind of a no man's land. If you keep feeding them the money and say, okay, go and capture one Taliban, we get you this much money, and then we back them up again, then they betray you guys, not Pakistanis does that. And one more thing, what's happening in Pakistan, that's the culture of those people who are sitting in the parliament, in where not a single candidate, you will say, is even graduated from the college very well. There is no doctors, there is no scientist, or there is no PhD or anybody.
Are you talking about Pakistan or Afghanistan, Naeem, there?
No, I'm talking about what's the relation, what's going in Afghanistan, and what happened with Osama there in Pakistan. Is nobody likes in Pakistan Osama. Nobody wants Osama in Pakistan and doing these things. This is just a single person, a one-man show, which created in Pakistan the whole culture, which took some people in Afghanistan and taking all the blame to Pakistan. So in Afghanistan, where the war which is going on is right and it should go on, but you guys have to give the transition to the Afghanis to do their nation building on whatever they want to do.
Make the transition, but then what comes? We'll look at that name. I appreciate your call. One more here from Steve in Boston. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
All Thanks right. What do you see?
Call.
Sure.
Real quick, it's a little bit off subject, but my question is, people talk about nation building and continuing the war over there, yet our deficit is going through the roof and many people are out of work here. How does that play into this role? It's costing the United States billions of dollars.
Yeah, I'm grateful for your call, Steve. Tom Johnson, let me come first to you with this issue of resources. How does that factor into the time equation? Our caller Naeem says you've got this kind of, he's describing this sort of no man's land picture there. It could be unsettled for a long, long time, but our resources are not infinite.
Oh, I think so. I think it's a very important question and a very important point. Let's just take the whole notion of Afghanization of the war, the transition to Afghan National Security Forces. I mean, the United States has spent an astounding $18 to $20 billion in reconstructing the Afghan National Army since 2002. And it still, it remains difficult to get an accurate number of the actual size of the force that's present for duty. I mean, this year we're going to spend about $12 billion on the Afghan National Security Force. And consider the fact that the entire budget of the Afghan government is about $4 billion.
So if we're not there, who pays for that military?
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. They can't sustain the type of military that they're trying to build. So there's all kinds of fiscal and budgetary questions that need to be brought into the discussion here. I mean, Afghanistan has one of the lowest revenue generating basis of any country in the world. And it's basically surviving financially right now because of outside sources and donors. So I think that this is a critical aspect, and it has tremendous implications for the different strategies that we're pursuing.
Stephen Biddle, how do we get to a kind of organic balance there? It may not be a sterling perfect democracy. Lord knows what will happen to Afghan women one day, but how do we get to even just a some kind of organic balance that would not require massive outside intervention to be, you know, to have some kind of stability? Or is that just forever out of reach?
Well, I think balance is exactly the right way to think about it. Secretary Gates famously suggested that we don't need Valhalla in South Asia. I think he probably meant Nirvana.
Okay.
Valhalla, you the fight Valkyries all day, you die, you get resurrected. That probably wasn't quite what he had in mind. But we don't need Nirvana, we can't live with Somalia. Somewhere in between is it seems to me, the right way to think about what we should be aiming for in Afghanistan. And I think the key in deciding where in the middle of that spectrum we ought to try to get is by referring back to the war aims that we're in the conflict to secure. We're there to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a base for striking us or the West. We're there to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a base for destabilizing Pakistan. An outcome that realizes those two rather modest goals is sufficient to meet our national security objectives. That does not require a gleaming example of modern, economically developed democracy in South Asia. It does require some sort of system of deals between the center and the periphery in Afghanistan such that there aren't incentives for locals in particular parts of the country to allow their territory to be used as terrorist base camps. That, I think, is within the realm of the doable. It's not, even so, within the realm of the cheap. It's this gets back to the question about whether or not the U.S. Financial picture will sustain what's required here. And I think on that issue, it's important to distinguish between the scale of effort and the duration of effort. As Alyssa Rubin was suggesting earlier, I think is exactly right. The central to our problem in Afghanistan right now is the belief on the part of many, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, that we're leaving. And therefore, everybody's hedging their bets in ways that make it substantially less likely that we'll get an acceptable outcome. I think one of the trade opportunities, one piece of the trade space that's open to us strategically, is to reduce somewhat the scale of effort, but relax the constraints on the duration of the effort such that we don't convince everybody in the region that we're heading for the exit as fast as we can go.
How far down do you pull that effort? Is that drones and special forces strike teams, or a bigger footprint than that?
If we go down to drones and special forces strike teams, that will be insufficient to prevent the government of Hamid Karzai from falling.
Wow.
And if that government falls, the efficacy of drones and special forces teams will go down the drain. I think if the effort is going to accomplish any of our goals, it has to be sufficient to enable the Karzai government to remain in power and the country not to descend into anarchy. That I think, is fundamentally antithetical to our war aims in the conflict.
Wow. Bob in Charlottesville, Virginia. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is, why does the Pakistani intelligence service and other arms of the Pakistani government continue to support the Taliban? What's their point? The Taliban seems to be acting in a manner adverse to Pakistan's best interests.
Thomas Johnson, let me put that to you.
Well, there's been a number of arguments placed relative to that question over the years. Many people will suggest that Pakistan looks at Afghanistan for strategic depth. That's to suggest that if there was a conventional war between India and Pakistan, the Indians would roll across the border and force the Pakistanis to retreat, and Afghanistan serves as sort of strategic depth relative to that. The other major point is that Pakistan views most of its foreign policy relative to India, and they already have an India enemy to their east, and they can't have to the west another enemy. So they need to have a friendly government, a Pashtun-led friendly government in Afghanistan. So, I mean, they have long looked at Afghanistan as vital to their strategic interests. So that's why they try to manipulate the situation, as people have suggested earlier, have tried to burn the candle at both ends. I think we've tended to believe what the Pakistanis, we've pretended to believe what the Pakistanis have told us over the years. But I think what happened a couple of days ago suggests that there were very important people in Pakistan aiding and abetting al-Qaeda. And I think they're continually aiding and abetting the Taliban, both in Baluchistan's Quetta as well as in Karachi. So I think that that the nexus between Afghanistan and Pakistan is very important.
Stephen Biddle, fill out that picture for us. There were these quite startling headlines just a couple of weeks ago about an April 16th meeting in Kabul where a big, powerful contingent from Pakistan, including the Prime Minister of Pakistan, flew to Kabul, and we are told in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and others, lobbied Hamid Karzai, Afghanistan's president, against building a long-term strategic partnership with the U.S., said you should ally with us, Pakistan, and with China. Dump the U.S., ally with us and China. What, after all this American effort, what's going on there, Stephen?
Well, shockingly enough, the Pakistanis denied that account of the meeting, but I think it's probably what happened. The whole problem in South Asia at the moment is that lots of people are engaging in hedging strategies and in counter-coercion campaigns that are designed either to build themselves a safety net in the event that the United States leaves, and in the meantime to push back against American pressure to reform their economies and governments in ways they don't want to do. So the Pakistanis, for example, who are the target of substantial strong-arming by the United States to clean up terrorist bases within Pakistan,
yep,
are trying to suggest to us that they've got alternatives to us. Press us too hard, you Americans? We'll go to the Chinese. Press us too hard, Americans? We'll make a deal with the Afghans and the Chinese, and we'll just forget about you. I doubt that they actually want any of those outcomes. I mean, certainly if you take a cold-eyed, clear-headed realist view of what's in Pakistan's self-interest, a United States departure from the region and reliance on China to solve their problems is not a particularly good program from Pakistan's self-interested standpoint. It is a way of getting the Americans to ease up on them, however, if they make us believe they might do it. Afghanistan is engaged in all sorts of similar combinations of hedging and pushback. Hamid Karzai likes to depict himself as an innocent bystander in some conflict between these American foreigners and these Taliban and al-Qaeda forces. In part, that's designed to suggest to us, you Americans, if you push me too hard on cleaning up corruption in my country, I've got alternatives. I don't need you.
But
there's a lot of strategic misrepresentation going on in both of those programs, and I think this April meeting had a lot of that going on in it as well.
Pretty astonishing headlines. Let's go to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and Vanessa. Vanessa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just came back from Afghanistan, serving in host province. And my question is, do you think that due to everything that's been going on and finding out that a lot of the insurgents are in Pakistan, and I know that Hillary Clinton had said before, and also Obama had said that if we had found out that more of the insurgents or any more action had been due because of Pakistan, that there would be some action taken. If there's any possibility that we will somehow have a U.S. presence in Pakistan, or just a stronger presence near the border.
Vanessa, may I ask you first? Thanks for your service. In what capacity were you serving there? Were you watching these issues?
Yes, I'm actually in the intelligence field.
So do you have a personal opinion or a professional opinion on, the importance of the insurgents' presence in Pakistan when it comes to the Afghan war?
Well, the only opinion that I can say, we monitor a lot of the activity with the insurgents because we were so close to the border, coming in and out,
yeah,
looking at the high-value targets coming in and out. So it's really hard to target some of those individuals when we know that they're moving back into Pakistan, and with all the rules in place of how we conduct fires along the border, we would have situations where we were getting fire from Pakistan, but we couldn't fire back into Pakistan.
I can imagine. Vanessa, welcome home, and thank you for your service there. And let us pick your question up in the time that we've got. Thomas Johnson, you know, there it is, right from the front lines, and she wants to know. I mean, here the U.S. went in for Osama bin Laden. Will it, might it, should it go into Pakistan after other high-value targets? Bing West was suggesting that.
Well, it presents problems, but I think that if they knew where people like Haqqani were at a particular time, that we might put forces on the ground. But putting a large footprint on the ground in Pakistan presents all kinds of problems for Islamabad domestically. The United States is not popular with the Pakistani population at all. And in fact, there's a large percentage of the Pakistani population that would like to see the Taliban win in Afghanistan. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult to be able to put a larger footprint on the ground to be able to go after some of these assets. But with that said, you know, we've had a very significant drone campaign for the last few years that has disrupted al-Qaeda as well as the Taliban. And there's been questions about moving the drone campaign into Balochistan to go after the Taliban that take refuge in Quetta. But that presents also problems because this is a massively urban area, mm-hmm. that is Quetta. So I think there's all kinds of problems for us to going across the border to seek some of these people.
Tom, we've just got a minute here. Stephen Biddle suggests maybe a lower spend but a longer-term presence in Afghanistan. What's your formula when it comes to time and American troops there?
Well, I tend to agree with Stephen. I think that we're going to have to bring some of our troops home. I think that inside the Beltway, they're grasping at straws. They're looking for a way to be able to extract themselves from Afghanistan. But, you know, we won't be able to do this. We won't be able to maintain a regime or in Kabul with just drones and special forces on the ground. So I think that we need to have a very serious national discussion what the future of American presence in Afghanistan looks like.
And if we let that regime go, does the old Taliban, you know, al-Qaeda-friendly, really come back? Maybe there'd be some other organic balance that would not require our great presence and intervention.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I think ultimately the Afghans have to solve this problem for themselves. And that's the real dilemma. I think that if we do pull out all of the international forces, the inevitable end will be a civil war in Afghanistan, which could take tens, if not hundreds of thousands of lives.
Wow, what stakes. Thomas Johnson at the Naval Postgraduate School, it's always good talking with you. Tough situation, even on this side of bin Laden passing from the scene. Thank you very much for being with us today, Tom.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Stephen Biddle, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, always good to have you as well. Thank you for your thoughts and insights today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.